Hey, it's the JRR. You talking to me podcast. I don't see anyone else here, but that is not true because I see Jude Fox. Jude, how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing well, and I've been blacksmithing all night long in preparation for this show.
Awesome. That'll give us some, I don't know, armor, some protection.
Maybe some swords.
From the throngs of fans coming at us. So, so we're gonna do a scene-by-scene breakdown of the show. We're going to do our opinion. We're going to try to keep it mostly to the TV show, and we might sprinkle in some lore, but we'll really get into the show versus lore more in the Helm's Deep Dive that we do during the week. So, before we begin, I just want to... I was just going to, you know, fill Jude in a little bit on our partner, Rowan.
Yeah, what's going on with Rowan today?
So, as you know, things didn't really work out with O'Leary. And so he went to visit his mom, and she's in an old age home. And he comes back and he tells me he's in love.
You had mentioned something about him meeting an older woman. He hasn't spoken to me in like 2 weeks. Yeah, I don't know what's going on.
He comes over and he says he's going to show me a picture, and I figure he's going to like take out his phone. Excuse me. And he takes out a Polaroid from his front pocket. And I'm like, that's a little weird. And it says on it, 1982. And I think it was like from his bar mitzvah. And he shows me, and it's like a pretty woman who's in her 40s. With him, he's like, I think he was the bar mitzvah boy. And some dude, I don't know. And so anyway, he says, that's her. And I'm like, so this picture says 1982, and she's like in her 40s. So anyway, she's super old. She's like a friend of the family, but now he's like in love with her. And... And he says she still looks pretty good.
Well, you know, it's relative. I mean, don't judge.
But that was like 40 years. She's like in her 80s. Anyway, so...
So no current pics.
He had a Polaroid in his front pocket that said 1982 on it.
It's Rowan.
All right. So let's get into the play-by-play of this episode. Yeah, I got to say, when I first saw this episode, I was a bit confused, and I didn't like it very much.
I had a couple of mixed feelings. I liked it more than I didn't, but there's a few things we'll get into.
I just misinterpreted it, actually. Like, after I watched it several times, then I realized it wasn't... Like, I was just kind of being harsh and rigid in my thinking, and the show was actually making a lot more sense than I thought it was initially. So I ended up coming out pretty good with this one. But anyway, let's start off. So Nori is hanging out with Meteor Man, and I have to say, Meteor Man is pretty cool. He looks like a pretty chill guy.
He looks like, you know, he can kick it back, have a few, and...
he's just like picking up the language a little bit. She's like, migration. And she's like, yay, migration. I don't know. That was the worst possible imitation of either thing.
Like my big thumb, something like
so,
that.
It was hilarious. So I really like Meteor Man, and I can't, he's not evil, and he's not going to be Sauron. So anyway, because he's cool. And so I think they're eating nuts, and...
oh, yeah, they are.
Stop.
Oh.
I'm talking about Meteor Man. Come on now.
What? Don't judge.
So, she is telling him about all the perils along the way, because when you're a Harfoot, there's a lot of them, and it's a long migration. So anyway, he thinks he might be a peril. He worries, and he cites the Fireflies dying. And she's like, no, you are a force of good, my friend. You are not a peril. You are good, because you're here to help.
Yeah, as opposed to Poppy's implication that he is a murderer of Fireflies. But then they kind of take off, right?
What? The Fireflies?
No, the Harfoots.
No, we're going to Largo and Marigold.
Right.
And Poppy is going to sing the Walkin' Song, And there's going to be a montage, Jude.
Yes, a map montage.
A map montage.
I love a map montage.
It's going to show their whole journey.
They travel quite a distance, I got to tell you.
You know the theme of the song she's singing, though?
So it's got a lot to do with walking.
It's the famous Tolkien quote, "Not all who wonder or wander are lost."
The song is very Tolkien-esque.
Now, there's a picture of Tolkien with that quote. There is.
Yes, yes, yes.
And so then we see the moon, and then we get a shot of the meteor impact when Meteor Man first came to Earth.
Yeah. And there's a wonderful transition between him actually lying there and the current time frame where everything is empty and no more fire, which kind of looks like a fiery eye, then turning to essentially a blue eye, which is just a beautiful shot and a beautiful transition, I think, and perhaps a little telling about Meteor Man and what his character might be.
Right, because it could go either way. Because what we see in the next scene are three, like, cult-looking people, and they're looking at that indentation in the ground, that burn in the ground, and they're studying it. And one has a helmet, like a soldier, and one has a shield that I believe has a star pattern that's the same as the constellation Meteor Man was drawing, which is weird. And the other one looks sort of like a priestess.
They look like they could have been right out of Heaven's Gate, just.
But the eyebrows. And anyway, like, so she's down there really in the dirt, digging in the dark dirt that the meteor light burned in, and she's studying it, and she looks up. And I have to say, it's a pretty menacing look on her face. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think they look incredibly ominous. If they do not turn out to be evil, I will eat a glass whole. I will just, there's no way they are not going to be evil.
You're
going to
eat a glass whole?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. What
does that mean?
Like, I'm talking about, you know, like a martini glass. I will crunch it and eat the entire thing.
I thought you were going to eat the whole of a glass.
Oh, well, that
sounds like nothingness.
Honestly, that would be much easier. You know, let me walk that
Let's
back.
Let's get on with the story. Because Adar, he's with an orc, and that orc's name is Grugzuk.
Is it really?
Yep. My name is Grugzuk. Anyway, so he makes Grugzuk expose his arm and burn.
What? Why do you have to say it like that?
He does. And he's like, as the guy's burning, he's slowly, calmly talking to him, going, "I wish that you could experience this nice warm sun like me."
But no, I'm just going to burn you.
No. And then he basically slowly covers him back up and tells him that the sun is going to, basically, that he's going to blot out the sun forever.
Yeah.
And that he's going to kind of miss it. Like, that part of him that knew its warmth will be gone with the sun.
There is a sense of parental love once again conveyed in that scene,
as
though,
he's torturing him a little bit.
Yeah,
it's like fire.
You know, you got to make him
sure,
a man.
Okay, yeah, that's whatever. Let's talk.
You got to make him a man. It's like, look, boy, come on.
Yeah, what does he say at the end?
Just be a man.
What does he say? He says, "Summon the legions. It is time." So then we cut to Bronwyn.
Yes.
And she is giving a speech about defending themselves and not swearing fealty to those fucking orcs, goddammit.
Yeah, no swearing.
And Saurons or whatever's running them. Stand and fight. And half the people will stand and fight, but you know what? Asshole fucking Waldrig.
Oh, fucking Waldrig.
And he's like, "You will die."
Just a right cunt.
Better bow to the supposed enemy.
Yep.
And our ancestors lived because they bowed to the enemy. And so half the people go with Waldrig.
Including
to bow to the enemy, including not our Rowan, but show Rowan.
Fucking Rowan. He's a little bastard.
But you know who doesn't go?
Theo.
Nope. That's right.
As much as Waldrig tries to coax him with his little candy and promises, Theo decides, nuh-uh.
Theo, it's our chance. It's our time. Nope. Waldrick, you're a dick. He's like, I'm not going with you.
Get lost, you perv.
So now we're at Numenor, and there's an expeditionary force, and they're getting ready. They're at the docks, and you know who wasn't? You know who's not going? It's Isildur.
Yeah, because, you know, he already fucked up.
He wasn't chosen. And he's going to speak to who? He's going to speak to Daddy.
Yeah, Daddy, please.
I actually heard you do that when he was a child. So anyway, Elendil, who is, he's basically punishing him for fucking up once again. He's like, are you on the Sea Watch? Are you on the Queen's Watch?
He's like, you could have been.
Do you even own a watch? Ha 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 ha. I'm funny. I'm a funny man. I'm Elendil. I'm a little sarcastic. So, yeah, he's like, he wants he wants Isildur to know he's not playing. Daddy's not bailing you out. You're fucked up. These other people didn't fuck up. They deserve to go over you.
You can go west, young man, just like you said you were going to.
Yeah, go west. He's not playing. And he's genuinely pissed off in a fatherly way.
Yeah, I kind of felt that it was a genuine scene. I actually kind of like that one.
It's a very typical, like, father-son or father-child thing. So anyway, now we're back at the capital, and Pharazôn, he's getting just shit on from the war opposition crowd as he's walking through to wherever he's going there. They think he's in league with a warmongering elf, and he's ignoring their... he's just trying to walk through. He's, like, not paying attention, trying to look straight ahead.
I mean, the people aren't altogether wrong.
Well, I'll tell you what. Kemen and Eärendil, they don't like this war. They're peacemongers.
Yeah, and is it just me or is anyone else getting a real Juliet and Romeo vibe from the two of them? I feel there's a very, you know, Capulet-Montague kind of situation going on.
I don't think
there.
There's as much getting in the way as there was in Romeo and Juliet, though.
Well, fair enough. It just, there definitely feels like there's these two houses that we know are at least somewhat at odds. And
they're
going to
definitely eventually be there.
Yes.
So, but she kind of really digs into him a little bit. And she's like, you know, he says when he speaks, his father's ears close up. And she's like, speak louder, you little bitch. Speak louder. All right. Be a man.
Yeah, she ain't having any of it.
So then we cut to Halbrand.
Showing off his smithing skills.
Damn, he's at work and he is making a badass sword. And it looks like this thing is damn near perfect. What do you think, Jude?
I think he is a master swordsmith. And I'm wondering how his smithing plays into his kingly parts of this character.
His kingly parts?
Yeah, his... Ooh, hey now. Hey now, where are we going with this? Where are we going with this? I mean, look, you want to go with that?
Halbrand's kingly parts. Okay, that's fine.
I mean, I do, but come on, doesn't everyone...
So anyway, he hands it off to the smith, and then he's taken to the queen, and Pharazôn and Galadriel, they're having a meeting, and they want to know some information about the Southlands, some of the locations. He seems to know where the enemy is probably going to head. And he suggests the Watchtower of Osterith. And we know that's exactly where they're going. And but Galadriel had basically lied. And she told the queen that he was going to go. And the queen kind of pissed off if he doesn't go because she staked her name on it. And so he's kind of pissing everyone off in a sense. And also the queen and Pharazôn leave. And Galadriel and Halbrand are now alone, and they think that they used each other. They're both accusing each other of using the other.
Yeah, there's a lot of talk about using one another, and it feels like a different conversation, I got to be honest.
Well, she says, you sold me out for a guild crest, basically. And he says, you used me, like, to drum up this war against your enemy.
And then she's like, no, you used me.
Yep. And it's going to seem like you used me, too.
Yeah. Again,
and,
a lot of
rips using. He rips the sigil off, and he slams it down.
This won't be the first time.
Yeah.
Or rather, won't be the last time.
Yeah, and he says, find another head to crown. He does not want to be king of anything.
Doesn't he, though?
You don't know.
Yeah.
There's Saurons in this show, and they haven't popped up yet. And we don't know. Maybe he's a Sauron.
He may be one.
You may be a Sauron.
And you, and you, and you.
And you, and you may be a Sauron.
Look under your seat.
Look, well, are you a Sauron? Do you have the powers of the Maya? So anyway, we're in the migration, and Nori and family are, they're going through a marshland now. And I guess there was some kind of blockage, and they had to go through it or something like that. And it's not going to be easier in the dark. And then Meteor Man's like, easier in the dark. I don't know. He doesn't sound like that, but he's got a cool voice. Yeah. Anyway, so all of a sudden we see wolf prints, and uh-oh, they're going to be wolves.
Well, now, is this before or after Sadak and Malva are speaking about...
I was going to say, that's the next thing. Okay. They're going to be wolves. I didn't say wolves now.
Ah, no,
I said
going to
be wolves.
Yep.
But Malva... She wants Sadak to take the wheels off their cart because she thinks the big dude is—he's causing problems. He's conspicuous.
Yeah, and, she's like, leave those motherfuckers behind. Let them die.
She is a cold-hearted bitch.
She is not having it.
No, she's hardcore about protecting the tribe, and really not hardcore about protecting Noreen's family at all.
She's all about the tribal mentality and that kind of a. Idea like you know, the Harfoots remind me of the Ewoks, just like, you know, cute little guys, but they will fucking eat you.
Yeah,
they will roast you alive, you know. No, don't kill them, they taste better when they're cooked alive, like, yeah. It's the same mentality. So, almost,
let's get back to the wolves attacking, and there's three big ones, and they have like saber teeth on both, up and down saber teeth too. And so they're about to rip into Nori, and Meteor Man just yeets one like it was a little fucking chihuahua, I have to say. He threw that shit harder than a motherfucker. It was about 20, 30 feet.
Oh, it made like a WWE SmackDown look like nothing.
But it gets up, and there's three wolves there waiting to attack, and Meteor Man just slams both hands on the ground, and he creates a shockwave through the forest, and it blows the wolves, I'd say, easy 15, 20 yards.
Just a little bit of magic. Just a little bit.
And the wolves are like, fuck it, and they run away. But Meteor Man is injured. His right arm looks like it's turned dark.
It's all black and blue.
Okay, so, yeah, I think Meteor Man's going to have to look into healing that arm up later on, and I'm pretty sure he's got some remedies there.
Yeah, I think he should ice it.
Yeah, definitely, and I think he's got an effective method. So, anyway, we're going to Numenor, and Galadriel, she's going to need to school these boys on some orc-fighting techniques, and she's going to boil it down. You know what she boils it down to, Jude?
Let's see, I think sharp blades, you know, and drawing blood.
Well, yeah, it's a stab, twist, gut technique. Stab, twist, gut. Boom. Move on. Stab, twist, gut.
That's how you kill an orc. I heard that in a club once.
Yeah, stab, twist, gut. By Orc Bukaki. Who can score some flesh on Galadriel, anyone who can give her a little cut with those real swords that they're play fighting with.
God, that sounds dirty.
Will be promoted to lieutenant, not lieutenant, lieutenant by Elendil.
And, lieutenant.
Elendil and Antamo, they're going to be in this fight to see who can become lieutenant by getting one little... strike in on Lady Galadriel, and she is just way, way too good for them. They can't hit her at all, and she is going to stress balance rather than strength when fighting these goddamn dirty old orcs. You want to be balanced.
Yes, she is.
And, you know, Isildur, he is down the street, and he hears about the bout, and he's going to go watch. And they're doing their dance. This is the kind of sword fighting that is mostly high fantasy. You will never, it doesn't ever get close to being realistic. To me, it's more like watching a ballet, but it's a pretty cool ballet. What do you think about that, Jude?
Yeah, no, I agree. It doesn't make a lot of sense. I'm not sure how much I actually dug it, but it was fun to watch. It was beautiful to look at. So, you know, just moving on and forgetting about the fact that they're maybe going to kill one another.
They should really be using practice swords for this little type of thing. But Galadriel's pretty confident. But eventually, Valendiel does get a little cut in on the her garment. He cuts her sleeve
a little bit. He doesn't score any flesh, but no. We're going to count it.
And he's going to be the lieutenant.
The lieutenant.
And everyone claps, and they're all happy, and Halbrand shows up. Yay. And Halbrand does a cool little move there. He's a little flip. He flips the sword up with his foot, swap, and catches it, hands it off.
Yeah, this is the first time that I think Galadriel and some other people have really seen him display his talents beyond blacksmithing like that.
True, true. The only guys that really saw it were the guys whose asses he kicked in the alley.
And they ain't saying anything to anyone.
Well, he was rabble-rousing in the streets, anti-elf style. That was that same guy.
A little bit.
But now we cut to Farazan and Kemen, father and son, and they're talking. And the gist of Farazan to his son is it's folly to kick against the current. The trick is you got to know which way it's going to turn next. So Kemen, he doesn't want Farazan to get dragged back into the elf-loving old ways of the old king. That's like passé. That is not how Kemen looks philosophically towards the ruling of Numenor. He is philosophically opposed to this war. He thinks it's warmongering, and Farazan kind of has a much deeper move planned. What does he plan to do, Jude? Do you remember that?
Well, I think he's looking to go out there, help install this new king who will be grateful and owe Numenor tribute and loyalty once they put him in charge.
Right. He's going to actually he looks at this as a power move to make over the low men of Middle-earth, helping them now and then taking their tribute and their trade and basically dominating them, and with that growing the what probably will be the economic military might of Numenor, and then eventually becoming more powerful and mastering the elves as well. So he is still very much anti-elf, but this is his long plan. He's got a long view on this. And I have to say, not that much unlike Mr. Sauron.
Yeah, no, he shows what a scheming motherfucker he really is.
And also, might I add, that his servants were very afraid of him, so he's probably likes his power.
Yeah,
he just gave them a look, and they all just were, like, cut out immediately.
Yeah, I think they should call him Don Farazan.
Yep. Oh, that's a good one, Jude. How did you think of that yourself?
Oh, my goodness, I'm so clever.
So now Miriel, the Queen Regent, is now with her father, Tar Palantir, and he is known for his visions of the future, hence the name, and he thinks it's a bad move. She's making a big mistake. All that awaits you in Numenor in Middle-earth is darkness.
Darkness.
So that ain't good.
Darkness, not the best. Not Middle-earth.
So, cut to the next scene, and we got Meteor Man. He's just the talk of the Harfoots town for his ass-kicking of them there wolves.
Yep.
But he himself, he's like in a trance, and he's healing his arm in the stream, and he's saying the word, I believe it's the word light?
It may be. They didn't give any clear subtitles or anything, so it's a little bit hard to make out what he's saying. Even Rowan had some trouble with translating some of the stuff in this episode. But
well, whatever he's saying, it's causing that water to freeze up around his arm, and Nori is gonna reach and grab him, and she's gonna get frozen to him in the process. And as he goes deeper into the trance, and finally it just gets heavier and heavier, and the trance climaxes with him having a vision of his body in that meteor fire ditch.
Climaxes.
And then, oh, that's so funny, Jude. Ha ha, I'm 12. And then a shockwave shoots Nori off of her feet. And and she's like laying on the ground, and she gets up, and when Meteor Man comes over and lightly puts his hand on her, she like is in shock, and she runs away from his touch. Yes. And his arm looks like it's healed now, and the trees behind him are kind of like shaken with his energy. So anyway, that's interesting. Is Meteor Man scary now to Nori?
I don't know. I kind of feel that, you know, he's showing what he's made of, and you know what he's made of is probably Maiar dust.
Oh, okay. And so he's good. He is not, well, I mean, that Sauron was Maiar.
Yeah, exactly.
So we don't know. It could go either way.
Yeah, still, not convinced that he's going to be anything but good, but, you know, they could throw us for a twist. We'll just have to wait and find out.
I think if Nori is scared, that's on her. But anyway, you don't touch a wizard when he's icing up. You know what I'm saying? He's icing up. So anyway, now we're in Lindon, and Gil-galad is eating dinner with Elrond and Durin and Celebrimbor, and they are his royal guest, and they're outside. And Gil-galad's being, you know, he's throwing some shade at Durin, asking him what's up with all the mining operations. They look like they're really going full bore over at Khazad Dûm, and what's up with that? And Doran's like, well, I also noticed that all of a sudden you elves are having a lot of activity, shipping off warriors and expanding cities all of a sudden. And you know what? He says, Jude, it's really funny. He goes, it typically takes you people weeks just to decide to take a shotgun wedding. So Elrond,
that's exactly where he was going with that.
Elrond cuts him off, tries to chill things out, but Durin,
he's gonna pull one.
He's got a little trick up his sleeve. It's called bullshitting.
He's good at it.
He is awesome. He's gonna just bullshit about the stone that this table is made of, and it resonates at a certain, and you can only find it at a certain depth. And anyway, it really makes Gil-galad feel like, takes him off his game a little bit, and he's like, oh, well, we have to give you this. It's a sacrilege for us to have it. Obviously, take it, use it as you will.
And I almost feel that Gil-galad might have even known that Durin was full of shit, but didn't want to push it. He was just trying to be like, all right, whatever, man, I don't give a damn. Take the goddamn table.
Yeah. He's single-minded here. He knows that the dwarves are in full gear for a reason. I think we know he knows the reason. So he privately now goes and accuses Elrond of lying to them, and he feels like Elrond, in turn, feels like Gil-galad's really used him.
Which he has.
And Gil-galad all of a sudden pulls this one on him. He pulls this kingly move. He's like, recite that myth. And Elrond's like, what? He's like, yes, the song of the roots of Hythaglia. He's like, oh, I got to recite it? Okay. It's mostly apocryphal. And he's just like, just shut up and tell the story. And he tells the story of the tree in which there was a lost Silmaril. And there was an elven warrior with a heart as pure as Manwë, pouring all his light into it. And a Balrog of Morgoth, pouring all of his hate into the tree. And lightning hit the tree while they were in battle. And it created this cosmic union of good and evil. Like a superpower peanut butter cup, Jude. You got your evil in my good.
Yeah, you're good and my evil.
Ooh, they taste great together. It's new Mithril buttercups. So that's how Mithril was made. It was made by this lightning strike during this good and evil processing. And it gets into the root of the trees, and then it goes into the mountain, into the misty mountains. And good and bad, and they may have make sweet love in the tree, and they have a little baby named Mithril. Or as the elves call it, gray glitter.
They're poets.
So, and he, the thing is, he wants Elrond to admit to him that the dwarves found it, and Elrond's like, no, I made a promise, I'm never going to say what I know. And
I will not break that promise until one or two scenes from now.
Right. Exactly.
No way.
But Gil-galad shows him the dying tree of Lindon. And he says that the elves' fate is the fate of the tree. They are the same. And the tree is dying, and the elves are going to die and fade into shadows.
And
they're going to need Mithril to sustain them. But Elrond, nope, his word is worth more than even the fate of his own people.
Oh, is it ever?
So,
Elrond.
And Gil-galad wants to remind him, if the elves abandon Middle-earth now, that's it. The world is doomed to be overrun by evil. And Elrond is left staring at his, the image of his father in the sky, I believe, looking for a sign of what to do.
So now, Rob, do you find it a little odd that elves would have these legends, whereas many of the elves that they know would be around when that was supposed to have happened? They either know it for a fact or they don't know. They know it's not true. Like,
why do elves need legends? They just have history. They were there. They remember it. They're from the first age anyway.
Yeah, most of them would be like, oh, I was a kid when that happened, I remember. But this is a legend, and apocryphal, apparently. Like, it's a little bit of an odd choice.
If you live thousands of years, how do you have apocryphal legends?
It does seem like a little bit strange, but like, once again, moving on.
We'll talk about that more in the deep dive. I want to really get into a little bit more of the differences between lore and the show. And see what I think it yields some interesting thought, but now we're in a bar. We're drinking with Numenoreans,
and we got more song.
And they got a drinking song. And Isildur comes in. And he wants to talk to Valendil, and he wants Valendil to help him get into the expeditionary force.
Yep. And what's it going to take for him to make up for sucker punching his buddy there?
Well, he is going to have to take two or three shots. I think he ends up taking two from Valendil in order to buy his forgiveness.
Yeah, and when you have three shots, how do you not use at least one to the crotch? I mean, come on. It's a free shot.
Because Numenoreans are we, and we don't do that.
Okay.
But he can't help him. He's not going to be able to get him in because, you know, that kid is just too unreliable. That is Isildur.
And that's after getting the shots in.
Right. Now, Kemen, we get to the scene. Kemen he's trying to burn the ships in order to show, to prevent them from going to war.
A little fuck that kid is.
That's messed up.
Less and less.
And Isildur is stowing away, so they're on the same ship, and they, of course, get into a conflict. Isildur's trying to stop him from burning the ships. Of course, the ships end up going up in the process. You know, shit gets spilled, and kaboom.
Yeah, but no one gets hurt, even though, you know, there apparently are a bunch of horses on those ships, so...
Nope. But Isildur does end up saving Kemen. And covering for his ass.
For some reason.
He covers for his asks, and he says...
some dumb reason.
Oh, he was in a fishing boat. Blah, blah, blah. Fishing boat? Really? That's a weak-ass story, but... now we cut to Elendil, and he's explaining. They're looking at the ships burning from Mirio and Farazan and Galadriel's meeting place. And now Farazan wants to say, wait, we got to postpone this war. You know, obviously, we don't have the people really behind us. If people are burning ships, we need to rethink this. And Galadriel's like, no, let's take the three ships that we got left and go ASAP. The enemy's getting stronger. And Muriel, she doesn't really know what to do. She needs to hold a council meeting in the morning. And Mr. Halbrand, he better be there.
Damn well better be there.
Okay, so now Celebrimbor is, he's talking to Elrond about the Mithril. And it, to me, it seems like Celebrimbor and Gil-galad knew about this whole thing from the start, and they were just using Elrond to get the inside skinny on the mining.
Yeah, poor Elrond can trust no one.
And, you know, Celebrimbor tells him he tested the shit, and God damn it, Ilúvatar, damn it, nothing diminishes its light. So vast quantities, if obtained, could save the elves by saturation of light from the Mithril. And anyway, so...
So did that Mithril that Celebrimbor tested, because after watching it a couple times myself, I still can't tell if that was something that the elves got independently, or if that was the Mithril that Elrond was given. Do you have any insights in that?
I don't think that was the Mithril that Elrond was given.
Okay, it just seems very ambiguous at this point.
I think they knew it well before Elrond.
I think they definitely knew it. I'm just talking about the actual sample.
I think they had one.
Okay.
These elves are clever, and they just needed Elrond to like really get in there and
just to confirm it, just to be like, fuck you.
Confirm it, and to, I think see how, and then talk to Doran. Because they're exploiting that relationship.
Right. Well, they still need them to mine it. They're not miners.
Oh, absolutely. And it's in there. That would be war. Yeah. Anyway, Halbrand, he's sweeping up. And Galadriel...
he's not sweeping up very well, by the way.
No.
why bother?
He's drama sweeping.
Why bother?
So Galadriel goes there, and she admits that she was wrong. It was wrong. She was using him. And she needs him to help them, though, tomorrow. And he is still seems pretty scarred about his ancestor's weakness and bending the knee. And also, if you knew what he did, I don't know what he did personally in this war-type situation.
Yeah, we're not
seems like he feels guilty enough about it to think that they would not be anywhere near him if they knew what he did. And she's like, sometimes... You know, to find the light, we must first touch the darkness.
I would love a reveal that just shows Halbrand using, like, elven babies as human torches.
What? What are you talking about?
Well, I mean, we don't know just how bad...
Stop. That's
his
stupid.
Crimes were.
Yeah.
Like, oh,
that's kind of funny.
It could be... Okay. Horrible.
Why did he need to do that?
He didn't. That's the point. Yeah,
and he had plenty of, you know, wax and fuel for the torches.
He didn't need that at all.
It's an emergency. It's not all right. All right.
For the hell of it.
Let's move on. So, so he wants to know whose dagger it was because he wants to cut the bullshit. Let me get to the core of your major, like, obsession. And she finally admits that she just can't stop. She can't stop. And
she's a little OCD.
Basically that the elves who sent her away, which would be Gil-galad and Elrond, they think she's as bad as Sauron in a certain way. That's basically what she says.
Yeah.
And Halbrand is, he feels sorry. He says he's sorry. And she tells him that there's no peace ever going to be anywhere in the world if they don't go and fight. And he holds his sigil pensively.
Can I just ask, what's up with the sigil that he has? It's on a little pouch. It's not just a sigil. It's not like an emblem. I'm still questioning, at least, what the hell is up with the pouch, because normally a sigil is going to be more like a pendant or medallion. This is it's inscribed or, you know, branded upon like a little pouch.
Yeah, he's, and it's nice. His grandma got it for him when he was like 8.
Where he keeps his weed stash or something?
Yeah, there's definitely weed in there. So, anyway, he's looking at it pensively, and then we cut to guess who? Guess who we cut to now, Jude?
Is it Daddy?
It's my favorite.
Is it your Daddy?
It is. Come on. Not. It's shitty fucking Waldrig.
Oh, okay.
He is bowing and sniveling.
Well, before a Daddy.
Before Adar. Yeah, before Adar's feet. You know what he says, Jude?
I like to call him Daddy.
Okay. You know what he says?
What's he say?
He says, "Lift us up from the muck and the filth, blah, 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 blah. I'm a little bitch. I hate him. I hate Waldrig."
Basically just being a pedo prick.
And he pledges to Sauron. And when he says that, fucking Adar kind of looks pissed.
Adar does not like being called Sauron.
No, even if he is Sauron.
Even if he is. He's like, no, that ain't me,
so,
buddy.
So, you know, he thought he was Sauron. And so he didn't like that. And he just fucking, he walks up to him pretty calmly. And he just slams him one-handed like fucking Captain fucking America, basically.
He throws him like he was Andre the Giant.
Don't you think he's that's a pretty powerful throw?
It's an elven throw. I feel like an elven versus human. I think that's where we're going with this. That's what I'm saying.
So, then Waldrig's like, "I'll serve you then." Not Sauron, whoever, whatever
you are.
I don't know. What's your name, Mitch? I'll serve you. And he's like a craven little bitch. And he's like, "Okay, yeah, but only blood can bind," which I think was a hit by Alice Cooper in 1974.
Yeah, baby.
So, only blood can bind. So that was more like Bowie.
A little Cooper.
He wants Waldrig to slice Rowan's throat, basically.
And you know what? We all agree.
Yeah, kind of.
Like, fuck that kid.
And it cuts away, but I do believe it's R.I.P. Rowan.
We can only hope, but I want to see it.
You know,
like,
what,
is it asking too much to show it? Like, please, please let us see Rowan's death. No offense, our Rowan.
I don't know. Whatever. We're not going to see it. Anyway. So it's now we cut to Arondir, and he is training Theo to shoot an arrow. But he really expresses that he's impressed by Theo's bravery. It took him like over 200 years to build it. He thinks Theo is pretty, he's the shit.
He did it in 14.
Yeah. So, and he believes that half the people that stayed, he knows that there's hope, basically. And then Theo shows the hilt, that weapon, whatever that dark weapon is. And Arondir then uncovers basically an ancient-looking relief.
He says, "I've seen that before."
Yeah. There's a relief in a tree, I think.
Yeah. No, it's on the wall of the tower. Okay. The walls to the tower.
It was covered up by some vegetation.
It's been grown over by vines, and Arondir being, you know, a little bit old.
It's a bas-relief.
He's like, "Hey, I remember that one."
Right.
And uncovers it to show.
It looks, there's a representation of that sword there, the whole sword.
Murdering someone.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And Arondir, he shows it to Bromwyn later, and he thinks that it is a key. And it's a key that's going to be used for evil.
Much like the plot of Ghostbusters 2.
Yeah, that kind of, or is that one?
Two.
The key holder and the key master?
Well, no, I'm talking about the baby and
I don't know.
And Viggo the Carpathian.
Okay. I kind of vaguely remember that. So anyway, so it's a key to something, and something the evil needs to unlock something. And
as it usually does.
And become an evil god.
Yeah, well,
that's,
you know,
what Adar wants to do.
Hey,
And how long is
this going to
be? You
got to have ambition. You got to have ambition.
It's going to be days, maybe hours. That's crazy.
Yeah, yeah.
And she's like hopeless when he says that.
I mean, hours to an elf is like, you know, a burp.
Right. But Bronwyn decides to bow to the enemy. If that's the case, they're going to be here in hours. We're doomed.
And yeah, she's not that dumb.
She's in a moment of desperation. And Arondil is trying to convince her.
I think if I was in her position, I would do the exact same thing because I'm a bitch.
You know what happens now, though? My favorite thing happens now. We cut to the orcs, and they are fucking chanting a war chant. And you know, Numbut, ooh, Numbut, ooh, ah, and they start saying other things in there. I don't know. I'm a fan. I'm a fan.
I liked it too. I'm pretty sure it translates to where there's a whip, there's a way.
That's awesome. There's other grunts and groans in there. There's a whole orc language that they are just chanting in. And it's a song that you can see orcs singing.
I can translate the whole song for you if you'd like.
Maybe for the deep dive. I kind of would like that. Oh, I'm a fan of orcs singing. So we cut to they're carrying that fucking table. Okay, show. Thanks. They're going to carry that table back to Casa Doom. We're talking about Elrond's little troop there.
Yep.
And the whole story is bullshit anyway. And so Dorne says, They're just like talking about it, and then, oh, here we go. Okay, I'm just prepared for this, because Doran says, "Get to the meat and give it to me raw." Okay, Jude.
Okay, subtext. Yeah, it's barely subtext.
Go ahead.
It's barely subtext at this point. Look, I said it before.
I admit it. They're gay because.
They are one of my favorite pairings on the show.
I love them together.
I love the actors. I love the dialogue. I love every moment they're on screen together.
Look,
but if you tell me there's not at least subtext there, go fuck yourself.
You can't. They just handed it to you on a silver platter.
I
can't defend it. They're carrying a table all the way from Linden to Casa Doom. First of all, come on, there's no horses or what? And then he says that about the meat, and people like Jude are going to talk.
And anyway, you know what? I got to be honest.
Wait, hold on a second.
Let's get
to the fact that, like, he tells him about the Mithril. He tells him that the fate of the elves is in his hands. And it is like such a, it's just ridiculous that they're, you know, it's all in whose hands? They're like teasing each other. My hands. You know, it's your hands. And they're smiling and looking, you know, it's fine, but you know, it's just kind of silly.
But you know what? I for one actually am really enjoying it, and I'm enjoying reading into the subtext. I think they're terrific together. I actually like the implication. I think it's interesting. It's cool. Is it
really sexual? I think it's just the way they're relating to each other.
You know what?
It's homoerotic.
I don't think it matters whether like where you want to draw the line at whatever their relationship was. The idea that this went beyond perhaps the friendship that you might expect.
I think it's a terrific idea of inclusion.
And
listen, this is what he says next, though. Fetch your feathery shirt. Let's start walking.
Well, yeah, that's funny because he's
fucking with him for being an elf. They all have those feathery fucking shirts, and he calls him out on it.
They're gonna fuck with one another. You know,
fetch your feathery shirts. I love that.
They're very good friends. Very good friends.
And now he's got to convince the old man. And they're friendly friends, and he's gonna. Elrond's like, tell Deesa the table's from me. Ha ha, friendly friends.
And Durin's like, yeah, whatever, buddy.
Yeah. Anyway, so now we're back in Numenor, and the queen summons Halbrand, and at first he leaves the sigil, but no, he comes back for it, and he's going, and...
Yeah, he cannot make up his mind. This whole episode, he goes back and forth, dropping the sigil, giving it away, picking it up.
You know what? He's getting on board, and
we see
Valendiel is there, and who is it? It's Isildur.
And what do we end up seeing? We see it's King Halbrand. Yeah, but we see
he going.
But we see we also see King Halbrand.
Yes, that's true.
Because he is definitely decked out in a regal correct form for the first time.
And but Isildur, he's gonna have to be the stable boy. Wah wah.
Oh boy.
Dad.
No.
Elendil.
That's funny.
Elendil, you're
that's
a joker.
That's a good joke.
But we're all going, so yay! And here comes Galadriel. Boom ba da boom. And she's got the Silmaril fresh, shiny blonde hair.
And also
the shining armor.
And also while we're on it. When we see them on the ship, we see finally the Numenorean armor, which I find really interesting because it looks like leather scale armor to me. It could be potentially a metal armor that's painted white, scale armor.
Mm-hmm.
However, it really moves and appears to be leather, which is completely decorative, you know, in any point in history. It's not a practical armor.
Is that so they can move in a quick way because they're fighting orcs and Galadriel's like, well, she's in better armor than that.
You're right. Possibly. However, again, it has no effectiveness on a battlefield, like in a medieval battlefield whatsoever. It was not used realistically. It was simply a cosplay kind of thing. And in the modern era, leather armor.
Maybe the rest of their armor's downstairs.
It's possible. I'm just curious to see how it plays out because it was definitely a head scratcher.
She and Halbrand shake hands. And there, the music swells triumphantly, and yes. It's triumphant departing, swelling music,
and we
sail into the sun.
And when Galadriel does walk on the boat with that shining armor, everyone kind of gives her a look, and their heads turn, kind of like when you see the nerdy girl like suddenly become quote unquote hot, like at the end of a teen romance. You know, comedy or drama where all of a sudden she takes off her glasses and everyone looks. Yeah, but the way everyone's reaction to her is shot in almost the exact same fashion that you'll see in those movies. And it's a little bit awkward, to be honest, when you look at that scene.
Well, I don't care.
Because your head did the same thing, didn't it?
No,
you went,
I mean,
ooh, hello.
I don't know.
I didn't notice you before, but now that you've got that armor on.
I mean, she was
hello.
She's Galadriel. She's supposed to be beautiful all the time, and
exactly.
She is.
So, like, all of a sudden, like, now everyone's looking at her.
I'm just saying,
do-do-do-do-do-do-do,
and the drums, ding-ding, ba-ba-boom, and you're, like, all into it. And I'm not like,
I don't know. I felt it was a little bit of a weird, yeah, well, you know, your yum's a little yuck.
Well, whatever. It's not my, you know what? I would rather watch, something that has more
TNA
in it, but not that, just a much more like deeply realistic thing. But I'm also invested in this.
We're not talking about butts. Like, I don't keep going on with that.
You have to suspend.
Like, you
got to
watch House of the Dragon if you want that.
Yes. Yep. But you have to suspend more disbelief, I think, in this.
Just a little tiny bit.
In the general texture of the show. But it's great because there's such
a
vast world.
I'm not shitting on the show. Don't get me wrong. I still love it.
Well,
I just
shit on it a little bit. Show.
Like,
carrying a table?
I just think that...
Carrying a table back to fucking Khazad Dûm.
To be honest, the head turn was like hit me a lot worse than the table. Okay. Like the head turns, like everyone looking at her all of a sudden like that. Like, no, they should have been looking at her the whole time. Fine. But all of a sudden they're looking at her. No. She is stunning no matter what. That's Galadriel. Like,
right.
Fine.
But they're like, also it's historic too, because they're back with an elf.
Eh.
It's historic.
Okay.
So do you think, what do you think about Adar? And why did he get so mad when Waldreg called him Sauron? That, like, stopped him sort of in his tracks.
Yeah, I kind of feel that he is perhaps a servant of Morgoth, yet not Sauron. I think that's a strong possibility. That maybe he considers Sauron a usurper of some sort. I think that that the idea of exactly who he is still deep in my mind. Like, is he one of the first orcs, or even perhaps proto-orcs, which, you know, as that being like one who ended up breeding the orcs, making him their literal father, their Iadar.
I think it's more inspired by a fallen elf, like a dark elf, like Eol or Meglin.
I think he's inspired.
The others, the story that I conflated, by the way, we'll talk about in the deep dive because it has to do with all this Silmaril stuff, but it's Medros.
Okay.
And Medros, he was hanging by his arm. And when taken prisoner by Sauron,
And I got him mixed up with Meglin.
Well, I did, possibly before that. But he is super important because he's one of the sons of Feanor, and he ends up with a Silmaril after Morgoth dies. And he's the one who...
Is taken out.
Yeah, right? They hew his feet, dead. And they put him in the chain, and he goes into the void.
They don't die.
But they can't kill him. He goes into the void. But the point is that the Silmaril burns Medros because he was still cursed with Feanor's curse. He wasn't clean, basically. The Silmarils burned him. And
he got to wash up.
And he dove into the fiery chasm of the earth with the Silmaril. And that could be related to this story about the Balrog and the true-hearted elf, because this particular elf, Medros, was a little bit of both, you know? He was... corrupted in being from Feanor's original sin, the sin of the father. And because he backed his father all the way, they had to give him the Silmaril back because it was his possession. But, you know, they slaughtered other elves for the ships, and they did lots of other pretty bad
things.
And they weren't going to share the Silmarils with the gods. Anyway, this is getting a little off topic for the show, but it does relate to it because it relates to the Mithril story. And so we'll get more into that in the deep dive. But
well, so to touch on that real quick, what are your thoughts on the way the show seems to be going with how Mithril came to be? Because... it is not a book lore thing at all. Like the creation of Mithril is never addressed by Tolkien, as far as I know. But clearly they've said here that it comes from the light of the lost Silmaril, and it is, you know, made its way into the heart of the Misty Mountains, and this is where it now resides. I'm not really sure where I fall on this at this point. As both a show and a book fan, I'm a little divided right now. How about you?
I like the bit of mythology that they're throwing in, if only I can talk about other Tolkien-related things about it and tie those into it. And
well, we can definitely do that.
I mean,
on the next
I
show.
Think that that's fun.
Yep.
The direction that they're taking it, there are a lot of other stories in the Silmarillion that would be fun. Let's see where this one goes. I think it's pretty cool. I'm okay with it. I want to see where it goes with the Mithril, but I also want to talk a little bit about the Harfoots.
Well, let's talk about them Harfoots.
So, what do you think is the real relationship with Meteor Man, with the Harfoots? Do you think that this I think that, I mean, if anything would tie it to Gandalf or Lorin, it would be his relationship with the hobbits in the movies and stuff.
Yeah, well, not just the movies. I mean, I think it definitely ties into his relationship in the books as well. It's kind of the idea of it creating a backstory which Tolkien just never got to. Essentially, it doesn't contradict anything that he had written that I can think of. But
he was mainly, when he did go down before being Gandalf, mm-hmm. Lorin, when right. the Maya, he mostly hung out with the elves yes. and didn't say anything about Harfoots.
Right, but again, it doesn't say that he didn't die.
How about Radagast?
Radagast, you know, we don't have, to be honest.
Why not a blue then? That's the whole thing.
Right, well, to be honest, the only one that we know of to have come down at all before being one of the Istari in a previous form is Olorin. And Olorin. Like, he's the only one that we know of. The Maiar form of Saruman, Radagast. I'm going to butcher the names. Alatar, Palatar, the Blue Wizards. Whatever the fuck their names
are. Just call them the Blue Wizards.
The Blue Wizards. Like, anyway, we don't have any indication that they had ever come down, whereas at least Tolkien did mention that Olorin did come down before that, and apparently, I believe, came down many times. So the idea that this may be one of his ventures, I'm not completely against it. I don't love it. I would rather it be one of the Blue Wizards, as we do know, according to Tolkien's later writings, that they did come down in the Second Age.
It would be nice to get a
new character.
The new character with a cool personality that's Gandalf, that we haven't but different,
seen before.
Different yeah. Gandalf people. Different I mean, Gandalf.
Look, you know, whether it's in the books or the movies, even Saruman and Radagast, what little we've seen of him. You know, they've all got similar traits.
Let me ask you this.
They're just a little bit different here and there.
Since, what about the that cult?
Ah, the cult. The Heaven's Gate. You know, the Middle Earth Heaven's Gate.
I don't know.
I think there's way too little to make of it just yet. Like, it could surprise us, and maybe they're good, and I'm going to have to eat a martini glass, which I really don't like the idea of.
There's no way they're good. Good people don't look like that. Did you see that? God. If you saw them on the street, you would not go near them. They didn't. They looked like they were up to evil.
Some people would go near them, though. That's the thing.
Mom,
some
Dad,
people would.
Don't touch it.
Some people would.
I don't know. I like the power of being able to yeet wolves, and I like the power of being able to slam the ground and make it quake.
I think that this is just one way or the other, giving us more indication that he's an Istari, or again a pre-Istari.
They're checking out his shit pretty yeah. deep. She had the dirt in her hands. Is he the enemy for them? Because we're always looking for the enemy. They're probably always looking for the enemy too.
Yeah, well, if they're evil and he is one of the Istari, then that would make sense.
But who are they? Who would be that? I mean, the Black Numenoreans were not until...
I feel this is another show creation.
There's so many lines that they can't cross, it seems like to me.
Yeah, I'm not seeing anywhere that this fits. I'm not saying there isn't any, or that I'm not going to see any online which pop
the lore
up.
Is but not,
right now, I'm the, not seeing any.
Yeah, the lore is not... I mean, they can't really do a lot of it. So what do you expect? But, you know, it's...
Well, they're doing more than we expected already, I think.
in terms of different from the lore? Which, speaking of which...
No, I mean in terms of what they're doing with Numenor, you know, the characters, some of the things that we thought maybe they couldn't use.
Keep in mind just a couple of gripes that I originally had, and I just want to just go touch on this real quick. I thought that the Numenorean... the amount of ships that they were sending was underwhelming compared to the lore. And then I realized that is probably, this is just the expeditionary force. It's going to be the small force, and Farazan is going to be the one, according like the lore, that's going to build up militaristically. That's a book to lore thing that I think may stick. I'm not doing a spoiler. I don't know if it's going to happen. That's just a prediction.
I still feel it's a little bit underwhelming that they're sending five ships and then down to three.
Yeah, it seems they're going to get their ass kicked, though, and that's going to set things up politically.
And even, you know, if they only have, you know, they have five ships to send... The idea that a seafaring nation, the most powerful in the world, actually, have five ships to send on an expeditionary force, and then they lose two, and, oh my God, I can't get any more, seems a little, like, I would like them to be like, oh, hey, no problem, yeah, we got more. But like, that would just be, it's an easy this fix is just a to show
this,
their power.
This is more of a timeline issue.
Right, I'm talking about their power.
They had that power in the lore well before Farazan.
Right.
But here they're having the power sort of after him. He's going after that power. Yeah. And I don't like it as much, and I don't understand why they had to do that.
They didn't have to.
But it's a different story. It's a writing issue. It's a different timeline.
It's another writing issue.
Right, but it all has to do with the timeline compression and what's happening when and what they needed to do to shift the power and to keep the Game of Thrones aspect in terms of the literal Game of Thrones, not the show.
Right.
Anyway.
Well, you know.
So we're getting...
Talking about writing issues, in terms of writing issues, I feel that, like, one, my biggest gripe of the show right now is the idea that the conversation between Elrond and Durin, when Elrond is trying to explain to him exactly what happened and why he essentially betrayed him, I feel that was handled very poorly. I feel that was handled poorly.
He really didn't betray him, though, because he... They figured it out,
and then they used him,
and he came clean with him in there, and it's about the fate of his people and possibly the fate of the world, and Doran knows it, and he's going with it.
Right, understood, and all that needed to be done there is explain, hey, you know, I didn't know, and, you know, I was tricked, please help us. You know, I came to you with honest intention.
He kind of did do that. He kind of did do that.
Did he?
I'm going to say yes.
Okay.
I'm going to say he did. Anyway, so we're going to get more into all of this stuff in the deep dive, and we're going to do a bunch of lore comparison, just because it's so interesting to try to connect these two worlds and to talk about. The differences and also the similar themes that run through it.
Yeah, so you like connecting things.
I do. Well, I like to exercise my mind as well as my potty parts. So anyway, this is the JRR You Tolkien to Me podcast, and I am Rob Law, and of course Rowan, our Tolkien scholar, isn't here tonight. And Jude, you want to take us out with any information?
Absolutely. If you want to contact us, you can email us at youtalkingtome@gmail.com. Join our Facebook group at You Talking To Me about the Fellowship. And I just want to remind everyone to like, subscribe, give us a 5-star rating wherever you find your podcast, and share with your friends to help grow the Fellowship. Until next week, bye-bye.